internal brain drain. And I'll get into what that is about. But this was actually one of the most interesting critiques of international aid that I heard through Temkin. And so I made this little example. You know, in this example, there's a child who's going to be in the pond drowning. And for some whatever reason, you know that this is going to happen. You're not there, but you are in some sort of position where you can move someone there. And so you're a responsible person. You want someone who can actually, you're like, oh, okay, well, there's going to be a child drowning. Who's the right person to save a child from drowning? Lifeguard. I know a great lifeguard. Steve the lifeguard is a fantastic lifeguard. He's very effective. He's a very righteous individual. He'll get the job done. I'm going to place Steve on the bridge. Perfect. Great. Steve saves the child. Makes perfect sense. Why would you do that? Here's the thing, though. On that day that Steve was at that bridge saving that child, Steve normally works at the beach, a very popular beach, very local beach, where hundreds of other people go. And on that day, he's not there. I'm not going to say whether something bad does or doesn't happen, but the point is that he's no longer at the position that he was at before, doing his job effectively. And to extend that problem even more so, perhaps they hire someone else. And perhaps it's Joe the lifeguard, and Joe is not good at his job. As a matter of fact, maybe even Joe steals from the petty cash, and Joe does a bunch of other things that he's not supposed to do, because originally he would have never been hired because people knew he was not right for the job. But because he's the only other option, because Steve is gone, they've had to put him in place, and so he's doing all sorts of other harms within the context of the job. And I thought that was a very interesting example. Maybe we'll just... Actually, you know what? I'm going to hold off and I'll say, let's open up for the discussion of my weird little examples and Temkin's as well of kind of dismantling the pond.
I think that the main issue in question here from an effective altruist perspective is you're stuck in the position of what should I do as an individual? And that has limitations. When you ask an individual to solve a social problem by themselves, not just a specific problem in a specific situation, but an overarching problem. Because when we talk about poverty or inequality, when we talk about these things on a global level, or even on a national level, we're not talking about specific questions. So when we use specific examples, it abstracts the situation in such a way as to remove necessary information. But it also asks a question of, okay, well, the problem is that I think we have two different types of decision-making. We have social decision-making, where groups basically decide rules or procedures for what is best for a group to mitigate against certain risks. And then we have individual decision-making, which kind of is independent. But to put it, to give yet another philosophical example here, if we had a problem of drowning children here in where I live in the city of Nanaimo, it's highly likely that what would happen is that people would create new laws or new systems to deal with that problem. So there's, you know, signs saying like no swimming after certain times in certain places. There are pools that will be closed to the public or areas that will be closed to the public for swimming where swimming is not allowed. Swim at your own risk signs. There are first responder services that are given the specific role of helping people in emergency situations. So in our society, like if you see a drowning child and it's like, okay, well, if I was at a lake and I saw this and I had training and I know how to swim, sure, I can probably save that child. If I am asking a different question, which is that from the societal perspective, does that mean I should, you know, open up my calendar to always be willing to save children as an individual? Is that the ethical response, or is the ethical response to support a system and rules that protect all of society better than one individual can? And I think this is the difficult situation, because in North America, you know, we have systems for dealing with these things and according to our own way, and other countries have systems for dealing with these situations in their own way. And it's not necessarily the case that we can, you know, export our systems of decision-making to their nations and that that will solve the problem, because we don't necessarily know what the problem is that is keeping them in poverty, and whether it is whether our system is, you know, the right system to the problem, if it is a systemic issue. But I think that your three examples, Hale, raise that kind of broader question of, okay, well, maybe I can do this much good on my own. However, maybe I can't do this much good on my own. Maybe an individual, when they're put up against a group which does not have, you know, the best interests of the child or the needy individual at heart, an individual is not necessarily able to confront that situation on their own and solve that problem. And that's it seems like a very negative and sad thing to say, is sometimes individuals aren't powerful enough or equipped enough to solve problems on their own. And I think that that is sometimes true. And that's why we need help to help other people. And we need to talk about these things in different ways than just the individual model. But I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, I really like what you said. And I think I'm actually going to jump on that in a moment here. But a little bit to what you were saying before, you know, where we talk about, okay, we have this situation going on. We've got a dire situation going on in whatever country it might be, right? Country needs support. Kind of piggybacking off my last example there of the, you know, replacement lifeguard. This is kind of what we mentioned earlier. When we give aid or when we help others, and especially in these very this is much more pronounced, I think, in much very large situations, like helping a country or a nation or a people or whatever it might be. There's so many more, as you kind of mentioned, there's so many actual factors that might go into that have that effect, and or can have effects that were unforeseen. And Temkin points out one of the ones, most interesting ones that I heard from him, and was kind of the point of that example, is when we send aid or aid organizations go into an impoverished country, they need workers. They need people to support the worthy cause that they are doing, right? That makes sense. That's perfect, right? And they generally look for the most capable individuals. And, you know, and those individuals will generally do a very good job in the context of the, you know, very focused support system that they're trying to enact. The issue is that this often has a very destabilizing effect on the nation generally, because what ends up happening is you end up pulling a bunch of people who were oftentimes doing very important work in other areas of the country, especially in things like government, where generally speaking, and this is something that Deaton points out, generally speaking, the biggest issue with these countries is not that they technically lack food. It's not that they, you know, are technically, you know, just a poor, generally, as a matter of fact, it's something called the resource curse. They're generally actually in a very resource-rich situation. It's that their governing system is very bad. Generally, corruption is the main issue. And there's the obvious ways that corruption leaks into aid, i.e. they just, like, steal or, like, coerce people or whatever it might be. But then there's another problem of you start pulling these people who might actually be good at their job, they might be one of the good ones in the government, whatever it might be, into these aid organizations. Who's going to replace them? Who's going to do that job now? Who's capable of doing that? Is it going to be someone who is as virtuous and upright and capable as them? Or is it going to be someone who's going to take advantage of the position and worsen the situation overall? And then oftentimes, you know, these people end up working with these organizations, they end up getting paid more, and they end up following these organizations out of the country, right? They end up, you know, it ends up being their ticket out, right? And so you're going to get both in a brain drain that's kind of internal, and then a more traditional international brain drain where people just start leaving, right? Who were actually supporting the system in a healthy manner. And it's those sorts of things that you're kind of mentioning there, where it's like, you don't, like, it's one of those things, those opportunity costs you don't really think about, right? Because if you're there to say, diminish the effects of AIDS or whatever it might be, that's a worthy cause. That's great. Of course you want people, you want very capable people helping with that. You know, maybe it's not actually the best idea to pull those people out of where they were before, because while, like, they might be helping with this specific issue, which is an important one, things are falling apart somewhere else. or it's contributing to the major, the biggest overall issue, which is that, you know, the government is getting more corrupt because of this movement of capable people out of the system. And therefore it's perpetuating the whole cycle over again.
And I think here we have to be careful, because essentially what we're doing is we're falling into the trap of trying to be a central planner, of trying to be the person who, you know, sits in the chair and oversees an operation, but never goes on the ground to see how it's going, or never sends someone on the ground to ask how it's going. I mean, you could say that this is a societal problem, but to put it in another perspective, you can't make perfect decisions with imperfect information. On the same side of things, that doesn't mean you should forbid people from making decisions that you think have a low probability of being successful. So for instance, let's say, you know, foreign aid is potentially problematic. Well, then is it necessary to ban foreign aid to certain countries entirely? That type of situation is kind of misguided, because from the consequentialist perspective, you might say, well, you know, we're doing more harm than good, so we should cut this off entirely. It's not necessarily going to help things in the long term. It's not going to, you're not maintaining a relationship with certain people, and you're specifically causing, you could say harm in some respects, because you're forcing people out of the ability to both communicate with you and work with you. So you're cutting off the potential for collaboration or for creating a better system. But as we said earlier, kind of with the gunman bridge example, there are some people who at the end of the day you just can't deal with as a government in an official capacity, and, you know, call that good. So then we are essentially getting into a realm of like, well, then is it better to help a nation without the express permission, or help the people of a nation without the express permission of its government? And then that leads down to a whole other type of rabbit holes, because now we're essentially operating out of deception, which most people would consider very unethical. So it, or at least most deontologists and virtue ethicists would consider unethical. I'm not going to say here or there on the consequentialist side of things. I think the biggest thing that I've heard with effective altruism is that it seems to me that it's very good for people who are kind of in the corporate environment, where it's like, okay, you know, we want to do the most good with the dollars that we have, and we want to use those dollars most effectively. So we can rate, you know, which charities are doing the most effective work by choosing some metric, and that metric is going to tell us, you know, how many people are helped, and we'll just help the most amount of people. And that's the best way to do things, is helping the most amount of people. And that seems like a fairly obvious thing that you could do, right? That helping more people is fundamentally better. But what do you mean by help, right? If you're giving someone an emergency meal once in a drought situation or an emergency situation that's going to last several months, you know, one meal is not fixing that situation. So then there's the question of like, well, how many meals should count as help in that situation? Or is providing a system of trade or just creating a better system of transport within that area so that other villages can help out as they would have without your intervention, is just assisting transportation all that's necessary. So it's the real world of helping people who are needy has a lot of complexity to it, and there are a variety of stakeholders involved. And I think that was one of the things that was interesting in the talk, was that he talked about there's a lot of moral blind spots which people don't want to think about. Some of those are the ideas of corruption and things like that, because it's like, well, what can we do about those types of things. They're beyond individual control. Maybe they make us less willing to help at all. And that's another type of problem where if you think of, if there think there's a situation where help is needed, but you can't help, well, then what is the moral obligation? Is the moral obligation to change that situation? It's a different situation entirely, isn't it?
And I don't think there's any, and I, like, I can't, I'm certainly not going to say I have a clear answer. And I don't think Temkin either comes up with a clear answer. I want to be clear with, like, the listeners and everybody, you know, Temkin is very much a guy who's clearly focused on helping those in need. And he certainly did not abandon that. I think that his criticisms come from a line of, you know, this strict utilitarian effective altruism is just not nearly as effective as we thought it was, kind of ironically. And that oftentimes we do more harm than good, but that, you know, he even admits, like, there are times where, like, you know, even if we, it does mean that we have to deal with and perhaps finance a very unsavory group of people, there are situations where we just need to step in because the, you know, the pressure and severity of what's going on for groups of innocent people is so large. I think it's, his whole project is about thinking more carefully and being less, you know, he brings up a really interesting, coming back to the pond, he came up with a really interesting, another alternative to the pond example, which was kind of like deconstructing, basically pointing out the moral alienness of the strict utilitarian structure, which, as he said, basically it's the normal pond example, except he says, you know, you're going across the pond, you see this kid drowning, you're about to jump in, then you look down your wrist, and you've got the super fancy watch on. And the watch has a super fancy clasp, and it's, like, very hard to get off. And so, you know, by the time you get the watch off, you know, the child will have drowned, and the watch is worth $10,000, $20,000. And so you say to yourself, okay, well, I can jump in the water, and I can save this kid. Or I can not jump in the water, save my watch, sell my watch, and donate that, and save 100 lives somewhere else on the planet, right? And, like, while that... like technically might be true, that's obviously a very, like, anyone, like, Temkin strip says, like, if you're someone who would go with that example, there's something wrong with you. Like, that is, you know, there's something weird about that. Part of that speaks to what I call a kind of localism of obligation, where it's not really clear, and I started to think about it a lot from his interviews. Perhaps there is something to be said where, like, if we have our particular energies, we can put our energy into helping other people. Perhaps there is something to be said for helping more in your own backyard. And I want to say something specific. As an individual, there's something more perhaps pertinent about you being able to have personal interactions with helping people who are in some sort of need, even if that need isn't that desperate, right? Maybe it's just spending time, you know, with your neighbor who's a widow and doesn't have a lot going on, you know, is kind of depressed. They might not be starving. They have lights on in their house. They have shelter. But you know that it would mean a lot to them and would be a great improvement in their day-to-day life on a more general level if you went and spent time with them, right? And so doing those sorts of little things. And so I think that there, and that's kind of a point that Temkin's making, that there's something about the localism of aid, particularly as an individual, that seems to have more pull than sometimes just writing a check and sending money somewhere, you know, and being told that it's going to help someone. And it might actually. But I think part of that, as we talked about the intermediacy of the other style of doing things, of just kind of giving aid, of donating money, right? Which is a lot. And here's the thing. I want to say effective altruism is a large movement. And there's a lot of people who criticize this classical style, not just Temkin, who are effective altruists. And have kind of moved away from the very classic, narrow Peter Singer's kind of old structure of it. In part because that's a lot of what it was at one point. It was basically a lot of, like, oh, you're like a middle class, upper middle class, North American, European, who's sort of more morally minded. You should give a portion of your like monthly check or income to charity. Like, that was the big push within the movement. And so trying to, in some ways, get away from that and start, you know, participating more in your local community. So there's that kind of the localism. The other thing which I've called is, thinking about that sort of stuff, I came up with a terrible name for it. It's, you know, right, I called it righteous helping is a notion of scale, because I couldn't think of a better way. But it's talking a little bit what you're saying there, which is perhaps bigger issues are the purview of bigger institutions. And this is something that Deaton specifically points out as well, and that Temkin, I think, was really won over by, was when it comes to helping, say, let's just use a real example. We're trying to help situation in the Congo, right? The Congo is, you know, has been the center of aid for a long time. All these aid organizations is very, very violent. It's very corrupt. It's unfortunate, in a very unfortunate state. It's a very resource-rich country, but it's effectively run by a number of warlords and warring groups and all this kind of stuff, right? Deaton and Temkin's point is that, like, you know, maybe, like, the root issue is not that, like, the Congo doesn't have the potential to be a successful nation. Like, it, like, on paper, it has all the stuff there. The issue is governance, right? The issue is very clearly corruption. And any aid, there is the issue, there is the example of aid structure going through Goma, which has kind of become like the classic example of aid gone awry, which was basically, you know, through the 90s and early 2000s, all these aid groups were working in the Congo, especially in the area of Goma, and billions of dollars went in, and basically all of it went to militant groups. Almost none of the money ended up reaching the people that was meant to help. It was basically all siphoned off and very much affected the, like, increased the warring situation in that country. And it's often held up as one of the prime examples of, like, how not to do international aid. If the scale is effective for me to help my neighbors, to help issues in my own community, right, and that's how I'm going to help, maybe it's the purview of, obviously, this is kind of clear, but, like, organizations like the UN and other clear international organizations to work to really facilitate a healthier system of government in that country. Obviously, that is way easier said than done. But their point is basically that funneling money into those situations, or goods even, a lot of the time, because they just get sold, like stolen and sold or whatever it might be, is not helping, often makes the situation worse. And that basically we need to work as an international community, and that does involve us in terms of participating in our own democracies, participating in our own social situations and social structures, to work towards saying, look, how do we make serious efforts to help these countries move towards a progress of better government, instead of trying to keep them on life support? And I think that's the kind of argument there as well. Again, I want to emphasize and say that is not an easy thing to do. That's not an easy task. But I do think it's kind of where Temkin and a lot of these people have sort of transitioned to thinking about these sorts of things.
The important thing to remember here is that in order for anything like this to be solved, in order for a real human need to be met, there has to be a real human being who's there to provide that help. And, you know, sometimes the best way to do that is through an organization like the UN. Sometimes the best way for something like that to happen is for an individual who knows, you know, those people, who has family in that country, to go back home and help out a little bit. Sometimes it's and this is something I learned, I don't know, a little while ago, but that most international transfers of wealth are actually due to people, usually like the children of parents who immigrate to other countries and sending money home to their parents. And so foreign aid makes up a much smaller percentage of the total amount of transfers, whereas a lot of the people who are transferring wealth are these individuals who want to support the people who they know in their home countries. It's, I guess, kind of to end on that kind of positive human note, by looking for the individual people who are, you know, already in these situations and making ourselves available to them, either as individuals or through the UN, I think that is positive direction. I'll say one more thing here, and that's that there's a lot of respect these days towards data that we can essentially take our moral decision-making and offload it to a data set and some statisticians, and then let them kind of make the decision for us. That's kind of a dangerous situation, because on one hand, it's incredibly important to have data collection methods, have feedback mechanisms on your policies and decisions, so you can know what the effects of those decisions actually are. rather than just assuming that you intervened and your help was helpful and effective. At the same time, we can't say that our statistics are infallible and actually represent absolute knowledge, because every statistic is based off of a specific situation. And while we have a lot of mathematics that we use to try to generalize that, oftentimes individual situations are not generalizable. So it may be possible that, you know, sometimes a foreign aid organization does everything right and there isn't a good result. And then another time they do everything right and there is a good result. And sometimes it's the result isn't always in our power, to put it that way. Sometimes we can only do so much, and we essentially put the best policies, the best people that we have in place, and then we have to wait on the result.
I don't think Temkin or anyone else, and certainly not myself, are saying that we need to abandon helping others, especially the most needy. You know, at the end of the day, there's not really anything profound to say, and Temkin's been clear about this, too. It's more, you mentioned basically, effective altruism for a long time was running off a very strict rule book, effectively, and basically saying, look, the rule book, it wasn't working the way we thought it should, and we need to be more flexible and we need to be more open in terms of kind of taking that pluralistic view in terms of understanding what is the right decision to be made. The calculus isn't all that there is. And just like you said, there are going to be times where, regardless of, we know there's going to be other bad consequences, we know it might not be the right thing in the long run, but we still need to intervene because of the amount of suffering that's happening. It's our duty. It's an obligation. Never mind the rule book, we need to get in there. But there are other times where, you know, the calculation might look great, but the reality is far different. And it's about also paying attention to that data, as you were saying, not treating it, you know, in a sacred manner, but paying attention to how it actually functions. But we're out of time, so I thank you for our listeners, and we'll see you next week. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. Thank you.
Archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Hi, we're Eli Myers.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.